This is KMUW Wichita Public Radio. Engage ICT Democracy on Tap is a community engagement event series of KMUW Wichita. The following event took place on August 8th at the Monarch in Wichita, Kansas.
Okay, welcome. Good evening and welcome to Engage ICT Democracy on Tap. Very happy to see our lovely crowd here this evening. We're going to have a really interesting discussion on the impact of debt on well-being, calling it wealth on health. It will be a good talk here. First off, we want to thank our partners and sponsors for this evening. First, the Monarch for the wonderful venue and the snacks. Monarch always does it right. They provide delicious delights. If you haven't had anything yet, go for it. Also, a big thank you to the Wichita Public Library. Each month, the library provides a further reading resources guide on the topics that we discuss. So if you want to know more about this after the discussion is over, or you know, either way, during, you can come up as well and get that guide and check out those resources. You can also see all of our additional resources from previous events and previous topics. So if you missed some kind of discussion and you were interested in it, you can pick that up as well. So feel free to do that. Also, a big thank you to volunteerkansas.org for sponsoring Engage ICT this year. Okay, so we'll go ahead and kick things off. We've got three wonderful panelists for you tonight. First, we have Dr. Sam Brown, who is the director of WCU's Hugo Wall School of Public Affairs. And next, we'll have Dr. Jessica Provines, Associate Director of WCU's Student Counseling and Testing Center. And then Jeff Witherspoon, who is the Executive Director of Consumer Credit Counseling Service here in Wichita. So let's start with Dr. Brown. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do and kind of your vantage point on the issue of wealth and debt and poverty on one's well-being. Welcome, Dr. Brown.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm Dr. Sam Brown. I'm the director of the Hugo Wall School of Public Affairs at WSU. The Hugo Wall School of Public Affairs trains students to be managers in the public and nonprofit sectors. We offer a Master's of Public Administration program to students who are interested in careers in those sectors. Many of our students aspire to be managers, or actually city managers, in the small towns here in Kansas. And as it turns out, Kansas is one of those states that takes public service seriously, in the sense that it's one of the most professionalized public service units in states in the country. In addition to providing a master's public administration program, we offer three research centers within the school. The first research center is the Kansas Public Finance Center, and it provides advice to policymakers on tax issues, impact assessments of new policies, and so forth. The second research center is the Environmental Finance Center. Is the microphone on, or should? Can you get closer to the micro? Okay. The Environmental Finance Center provides advice to local governments around waste and utility rate setting and management issues. And then the third research center within the school is the Public Policy and Management Center. It's the historical center for urban studies that was started by Hugo Wall himself back in the 1950s. They provide technical assistance to local governments, training for public officials, particularly new elected officials. So my vantage point on this topic of health and wealth, or debt and its impact, comes from my background as a health services researcher. So I spent 20 years as a researcher in the field of health services. 10 of those years were spent at the federal level with the Office of Research and Demonstrations at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, where I had the opportunity to shape health policy at the national level, designing new ways to finance healthcare and new ways to deliver healthcare services. Prior to starting my academic career about 15 years ago, I was an associate director for policy analysis and research for the state of Maryland's healthcare rate setting commission. This was a commission that set hospital reimbursement rates for the state of Maryland. So in this question of wealth and health, my perspective is this. Essentially, there haven't been many studies done around wealth and health and that connection directly. So most of us have a common sense understanding of what it means to relate wealth to health. And what we assume is that the more money you have, the more healthcare you can buy. And so that natural connection is really around, you assume that people with more wealth have better health. And while that may be true, it's probably not true because of the reasons that you think. There's actually a paradox with respect to health. This nation spends more on healthcare services than any nation in the world. In 2015, it was $3.2 trillion. Yet, the outcomes that we get in terms of measures of health are poorer than most other industrialized countries in the world. For example, in 1960, we ranked number 11th among industrialized countries on the outcome of infant mortality. By the year 2014, we ranked 31st, behind Korea. Can you imagine that? So how can this be? What is this healthcare paradox? As it turns out, the path to better health is not through more or better healthcare. It's actually these issues that we're going to talk about tonight, the social determinants of health. And so if we take a look at the causes of health or the determinants of health, only about 10% of health is determined by healthcare itself. Another 10% is determined by genetics. A whopping 80% of a person's health is determined by three factors. Social factors, environmental factors, and behavioral factors. So imagine that. The challenge is that we spend 95% of that $3.2 trillion on healthcare. Only 5% is spent on public health, or those measures that really have a direct relationship with health itself. And so the question is, what is that relationship between health necessarily and wealth? And I can tell you that the studies that we are aware of have linked this measure that we call socioeconomic status with health. And so when we look at socioeconomic status, we're talking about three things. We're talking about education, occupation, and your status. And so when we look at the factor of income, income is inversely related, directly related to health in the sense that the more income an individual has, the better their health tends to be. So the flip side of this question is the impact of, say, debt on health is that the more debt that you have, the less wealth that you have. And the less wealth that you have, probably you have less income. And that's going to, that has a negative impact on your health. And so people who have more debt tend to have more stress, and with stress comes worse health outcomes. And I could go down the list with other factors, like education. Education, the more education one has, the better their health tends to be, right? And so we do have established relationships among some of these variables with the outcome of health itself. And so that's my broad perspective. You know, I'm looking forward to questions, but I'll turn it over to the next panelist.
Thank you, Sam. Next, Dr. Jessica Provines or Provines?
Provines.
Provines. Go ahead, Jessica.
Hi. Like she said, I'm Dr. Jessica Provines, and I am a licensed clinical psychologist in the state of Kansas and have am the newly promoted director of the Counseling and Testing Center at Wichita State University. In my department, we are the mental health care providers for the WSU students. And I've been in our center now for, in various capacities, for 15 years. And once upon a time, was a graduate student there getting my own training and in my own amount of debt and college debt as I was trying to pursue, you know, a graduate education. And I don't want to talk about my personal stress that caused, but believe me, it was there. I remember feeling food insecure and thinking, where am I, you know, going to get my next meal? And I'm very proud to say that Wichita State University recognizes that a lot of our students are in that situation as well, and have, with the help of the Student Government Association, has started a food panel for students. So the term a starving graduate student hopefully won't be true at our university anymore. At the counseling center, some of the things that, you know, we do, we provide the mental health services for students, and we also provide a lot of training for graduate students as well, students that are pursuing their degrees in a mental health related field. So I see this in my daily work, not only with the clients that I serve, but also with the students that are in training and are assuming massive amounts of debt, particularly some that are attending some of more of your professional schools where the tuition rates are incredibly high. We have students that are transferring to us to complete internships from all over the country, and many of them graduating with upwards of $100,000 in debt. And going into a behavioral health field where sometimes, you know, the rate of pay is not as high as one would have hoped when they started out in these tracks. From my perspective, I bring the mental health piece here. I see it every day. You know, students are coming in with depression, anxiety, they're afraid how if they're going to be evicted from their home. You know, they are worried about needing to drop out of classes so they can provide for their families. And this impacts, you know, some shame around the amount of debt that they accumulate, maybe a secret that they're keeping, which can then accumulate into more debt because they don't, you know, want to portray a certain kind of lifestyle, and keep this a secret from others. It can lead to a lot of relationship problems, resentment with your partner over spending habits or those who they feel maybe brought more debt into the relationship. We know that financial strain is one of the largest problems and relators in divorce. I see a lot of students, you know, who are afraid and they're worried if they're going to make a living wage, and how they're going to be able to support their families. So it impacts all areas of mental health. There's anger sometimes and resentment, particularly if debt may have been caused from an event that was outside of their control, perhaps a car accident, and then they have healthcare bills and things that they can't get out from underneath. And there also tends to be some regret as well about maybe their own personal spending habits. And so those are the things that I try and help with, and I hear a lot about on a daily basis.
Thank you, Jessica. Our final panelist this evening, Jeff Witherspoon, why don't you give your perspective and a little bit about what you do?
Sure. Thank you for allowing me to come this evening. I am very proud to run a nonprofit agency here in Wichita called Consumer Credit Counseling Service. How many people have actually heard of Consumer Credit Counseling Service? Okay, that's good. We've been in business for 32 years. Our sole focus is to give people financial advice and options. Most of our services are free of charge, and I'd like to echo a lot of what I've heard. We're seeing very similar situations. I've been with the agency for 21 years. The first 4 years I was a counselor. The last 17 I've been the director. We are starting to get busy again, so I'm getting a little nervous. So I've had to counsel more than I've had to in the past, starting to see a lot more situations that are difficult, to say the least. We're starting to see a lot of elderly folks coming in more and more, which is very difficult for counselors to talk to the elderly. We're realizing we're trying to fix problems that might have happened 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago. And medical debt, when I first started, wasn't even around. It seemed like insurance paid for the majority of the bills, but anymore that's not the case. And we're starting to see more and more people having to file bankruptcy because of their medical problems and their medical situations. Just last week I had a teacher that came in for counseling, and she was in a car wreck, and she went to the emergency room, and her bills after everything was paid for by insurance was over $3,000. So even with insurance, we're starting to see bigger and bigger debts coming down the pike. And like I said, it's very interesting to me how that has changed in the 21 years that I've done this. And a lot of times, medical bills may not be the total problem, but you start adding that on to houses, car payments, credit card debt. And we're starting to see that a lot too, where people are putting their medical bills on credit cards and then having a harder and harder time to pay for that. And then something I'd like to discuss this evening, if there's any doctors in the room that would be willing to share, I'm starting to see people who are having credit card debt because of their medical situations, and I'm being told that they're being asked by the doctors or the hospitals at time of service to immediately put their bills on their credit cards at very high interest rates. And I understand it to some extent because they want to get paid, but it's become a problem for us to have to deal with that. Consumer Credit Counseling Service, like I said, is owned by you, the public, and we also partner with a lot of other nonprofits, and one of the things we do is we have a financial series at the library. So if you're interested, those are free of charge, and if you want to hit me up at the end of the presentation, I can give you the dates for those classes that are coming up. We taught one on basics of investing just last week, and I had 35 folks come, so I was very happy about that, and we'd like to have as many people that want to come get some free advice. I teach those classes personally, and my passion is Wichita. I was born and raised here, and anything I can do to give back to Wichita, I want to try to do. So I'm going to leave it at that because I'm hoping there's a lot of questions, and I think we're all excited about answering them.
Thank you. Let's have another round of applause for our panel. So as we get going here tonight, if you hadn't noticed, please look at the table where you're sitting. There should be question slips and pens on all of the tables. If you don't see them, you can also come up to our info table and get more there. But ask questions. Write out your question for me, and I will read it for you just throughout the discussion tonight. So hope to have a lot of questions from you guys, and let's go ahead and jump in here. And talk more about kind of how this situation came to be, if you all want to weigh in on this. When did it get this dire, and what changed to kind of bring this situation about? Do you want to kick us off, Sam?
So by the situation, you mean
the masses of debt that people are accumulating.
Well, I think the growth of consumer debt has been increasing exponentially over time. But this link between debt and health, we've actually begun to recognize that more recently. And it's only because most people assume that medical causes create the health status and the outcomes that we see. And they've been ignoring the non-medical causes, those social, behavioral, and environmental factors. And so I think what we have now is a better understanding of what are the causes of differences in health status among different groups. So we now recognize what's called the social determinants of health, which means, you know, things like debt, your income, wealth, the neighborhoods that you live in, is now more recognized now than it ever has been before. And we tend to have a universal agreement all around the world now around this notion that social causes of health, in many cases, are more significant than medical causes, which would highlight this notion of the link between debt and health. So I think that, has the problem gotten worse? My guess is that we now have a better understanding of what those causes are, and we're now in a better position to address them, right? If we can redirect some of the resources away from direct healthcare services and toward more of these preventive measures, like say debt counseling, then we'll go a long way toward changing the health status and outcomes of citizens, right? If you wanna affect health status or a person's life chances, change their behavior. So there are actually some very basic things that we can do. The two leading causes of poor health are smoking cigarettes and obesity. Right? Those are things, fortunately, that we can change. And I think that we're now beginning to recognize that there are interventions around smoking cessation and obesity reduction or prevention that work. Whereas prior, we were reluctant to address the social, behavioral, and environmental factors that contribute to health because we didn't understand the causal connections. We didn't have good solutions. But now we do. So I think that what has changed is our understanding of the underlying causes of health, and that puts us in a better position to address it.
Thank you. Anyone else want to address that concept of kind of how we got to where we are now?
I don't have some of the, you know, economic perspective, but just personally, after the crash of 2008, I saw a major increase in the insecurity of our students and their concern about their ability to go out into the workforce and make that living wage. And so that added a lot to the anxiety and the worry, that and fear that I saw about security, about the futures.
I want to ask Jessica specifically if you can talk a little bit about student debt, and you know, there's been such an increase in student loan debt. Where is that coming from? Is it just that more students are going to school, whether or not they can really afford it, or what? Are the interest rates higher? What's going on there?
Those are some of the areas that are maybe a little out of, you know, my expertise. But one thing that I do see is a lot of students, you know, that are maybe unemployed because unemployment rates are going up. They're coming back to school and they're trying to find a second career. And so not only are they dealing with debt and financial strain from their unemployment, but then they're adding new debt on top of that and trying to find another career. And we see students, you know, returning adult students who are, you know, trying to pick up their lives and start over again on a regular basis.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of younger folks coming in, and they have student loan debt. And again, that was something I didn't see a lot 10, 15 years ago. Part of the problem is the state has stopped funding colleges at the level that they used to, and so those costs have been shifted onto the students. That's where a lot of the cost increase has come from, and the students are having to pay for that.
Whereas before there were more scholarships and that sort of thing?
Well, and the state actually,
exactly,
the state subsidized the colleges, and so that's where we saw that shift. The other thing I'm seeing a lot of, it seems like the folks are taking longer to graduate college than they used to as well. When I was in school, you know, 4 years was what you really shot for, but it seems like they're taking longer, and a lot of what I talk to younger people about, I'm very fortunate I get to talk to high school students, is you think about the education costs just for the tuition, but they don't think about how expensive it is to go away to school because then they have to pay for room and board. And one of the things I try to encourage the kids here in Wichita is consider going to a junior college or going to Wichita State for a year or two and get the basics out of the way and then transfer to the four-year school to help keep your costs down. I always say that mom and dad don't mind you being in their basement when you're 18 or 19, but we don't want you there when you're 25 and 30. So college costs have gone up, but a lot of it is because it's not being subsidized. And the other thing is the federal government backs these loans, and they make pretty good money off of them because the interest rates on a student loan are 6 to 7% if they're subsidized, and so they're making money off of students going to college.
So what's really at issue here? Is there just sort of a blanket kind of ignorance or lack of knowledge about how to make good financial decisions? What do you guys think is, you know, the root of this part of the issue?
Well, part of it might be the focus of both K through 12 education and higher education. Keep in mind that we're training students to be productive members of society, which oftentimes means we're preparing them to go and work for someone. So a typical course in finance focuses less on personal finance and more on either corporate or organizational or nonprofit or public finance. And so I think the educational system doesn't prepare students very well to manage their own personal finances, to make good choices around purchasing or good investment options. I would have to put a plug in for WSU, though, since I'm an employee. I would encourage, if there are any students out there who are considering higher education, to consider WSU as your first and final destination. We can offer you, you know, that first 2 years and the second 2 years, all the way through a PhD if you want one. And so I think that WSU is competitive with many of the universities throughout the state, and we do an outstanding job in preparing students for careers, particularly in my area, in public administration, where most of our graduates actually do get jobs.
Did anyone else want to weigh in on kind of whether the fundamental problem is that people are not educated about how to make good financial decisions?
I would say that is very true. And one thing that I would advocate for is to have personal finance taught in the high schools and to catch people before they become adults and start making mistakes. It's amazing to me some of the things I see in my job. I'm going to write a book one day, so hopefully everybody will buy it, because it's amazing some of the mistakes just right out of the gate that people are making. If you stop and think about it, you have an 18-year-old who's getting ready to make a college choice, and that's a huge financial decision to make, and they're not really prepared to make it, and then they can get into debt. You know, I've counseled people that have upwards of $100,000 in debt and they're going into social work. And if you know, that is a career that doesn't pay very much money. So, you know, why did you borrow so much money for a career that's not going to pay much? And that money has to be paid back. And that's something people don't understand, that money is backed by the government. So it does eventually have to be paid back. And I think personal finance needs to be made mandatory in the high schools. If I had a wish, that's one of them.
I have a question from the audience, more of a topic for discussion. Payday loans and borrowing against your car title. What are your thoughts on that? Jeff, I think you want to jump in here.
Oh, thanks. That's what I deal with a lot. Payday loans are not good. They are the loan of last resort. You have to be very desperate to even consider getting one. And they're designed, if you stop and think about it, to trap somebody, because say if you get a $500 payday loan, it has to be paid back in 2 weeks. Well, most people don't have the ability to pay it back in 2 weeks, so you just rewrite the loan. And then if you can't pay it again in 2 weeks, you just rewrite it and rewrite it. There are actually ways to get out of that, and I'd be happy to share those with you if you want to talk to me about it. There's some issues that you'll have to do that will hurt your credit, that we can talk about strategies to get out of that. Auto title loans are even worse. Matter of fact, I had a woman that called me the other day, and she had gotten two of them. I don't know how she did it, but she had two loans against one vehicle, and she's on Social Security disability, and they were coming that day to come take her vehicle, and she was told that I could help. but I don't have any collateral. I don't have any clout with those loans. If you put your car up as collateral and don't make the payment, they're going to come take it. There's just nothing you can do about it.
So let's go back to the topic of health. How does, and you know, we can continue talking about students, but maybe to broaden this a little bit, in what ways does being in, either being in poverty or just kind of being in debt, how do those situations affect someone's physical or mental health?
You want me to pick up that one? Well, as it turns out, poverty causes about 6% of the death rate. So there's actually a direct correlation between poverty and health. So people with lower income tend to have a lower health status. They have less access to health care. So it becomes a cycle of, you know, lack of access and poor health status, poor access to care. And so there is a direct correlation between poverty, which in essence is low income. So I mentioned before that the relationship between income, there's a relationship between income and health. And we know more about that relationship than we do about wealth and health. And so as it turns out, income explains a large percent of the variation in health status and outcomes that we see across the various spectrum. One point to make is that it's not a direct linear relationship, right? And so middle-class families tend to have very good access to care, and they're able to get their healthcare issues on the agenda in ways that lower income or folks in poverty can't. So one of the larger challenges of persons who live in poverty is that they really don't have a voice in a political process to dictate how dollars get spent, what issues get researched, and how their problems can be taken care of, right? I'm not going to point any fingers, but there are certain diseases that we spend a lot of federal money to research. And as a result, we get advances in medical care that tend to benefit certain groups that have more political power. And so this factor of poverty or low income, it has a cascading effect on the health of individuals because it affects them in a number of different ways.
So I kind of want to follow up on that. What diseases are kind of not being addressed that are kind of causing? I mean, I'm maybe guessing diabetes, but what are you seeing there?
Diabetes actually affects the broader population. In fact, you know, I'm doing some research down around diabetes, taking a look at hospital discharge in the state of Maryland. And it, as it turns out, one in every five patients that go into the hospital for diabetes. So some of the issues that may not get addressed for a lower income family are those environmental causes. Remember I said that 80% of the determinants of health are social, behavioral, and environmental. So it's things like sort of lead paint poisoning, or the effects of the environments that lower income people tend to be exposed to. They're more likely to work in higher risk environments at work. They're more likely to live in housing that's a poor quality. And we don't understand what those causal relationships are between the environments that lower income people find themselves in and their health status and their health outcomes. So that's one area.
Jessica, maybe you want to follow this up a little bit with a glimpse of mental health and how that is affected. And then if you can speak beyond just the student population, that would be great.
Yeah, there is a research out there on correlational findings between increased rates of depression and anxiety and risk for suicide that is related to economic stress as well. And, you know, those might not be direct causal relationships, but we do know that when there is financial strain, that there's more risk for those mental health issues.
I have a question from the audience that sort of dovetails well into this. Have you studied the health and productivity impacts of financial stress in the workplace?
I've not looked at financial stress in the workplace, but the effect of... What was the first part of the question?
Just health and productivity.
Okay.
How it impacts.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So as it turns out, the relatively poor health status of Americans with respect to other industrialized countries affects our productivity. So one of the arguments for investing more money into public health or more money into prevention is so that we can actually get to the actual determinants of health, which are in many cases non-medical. And if we do that, it will actually enhance the productivity of this country as well as improving health outcomes for individuals. So it's a win-win.
And we know that when individuals have higher stress levels, that their ability to focus and concentrate and be productive, you know, in their daily work is impacted. And, you know, we know that financial strain is one of the top-rated causes of increased stress in a person's life.
Do you have anything you'd like?
Yeah, and I would agree with that. We see that a lot in our counseling. There's a lot of stress. It also affects the health, but it also affects the marriage and the family as well. When there's that much stress going on financially, it leads to a lot of other issues, especially in the family, and it leads to divorce a lot of times. I hear that a lot in my counseling, where the couple are blaming each other for the finances. And after we look at their actual budget, it's really more of an issue that there just isn't enough money coming in to try to keep a roof over their head, food in their mouth, and utilities on, and raise the number of children they've chosen to have.
So this is sort of a follow-up to that. I'd like to know kind of what physical ways financial strain manifests in different groups of people. So we're talking kind of, I guess, middle age, or, you know, when you're raising your family, if you see more trends there. And then with younger groups and maybe senior citizens, how does this strain manifest differently in the health of different groups?
Anyone can jump in. So as it turns out, when I mentioned in my opening statement that the United States compares unfavorably to other industrialized countries, the one area where we compare favorably is if you hit the age of 65. So if you can hit the age of 65 in this country, you're more likely to live a longer life. And so the impact of wealth and these other factors on the elderly, if you can make it to that certain point, things tend to get better. But in terms of the impact on other groups, we tend to segment groups into ethnicity, race, and some of these other factors, where the common link for many of them is really low income, right? And so, as it turns out, when we, you know, focus on this group composition and sort of dividing people, you know, among races and ethnicity, we actually ignore certain groups. And one of the groups that gets ignored is the low-income white population, right? Which causes society to pay less attention to that group, and they recognize this, right? And so there's a tremendous opportunity for people to align around this idea around income, you know, and not to say that these other distinctions don't matter, but those other distinctions are not causal factors, right? Race does not cause health. It doesn't. It just so happens that people are in a certain social category of a race experience disproportionate impacts of this link between income. They're more likely to find themselves in a lower income, and therefore that puts them in a bad neighborhood, and then there's a cascading effect from there. But the same is true for other groups. And so I'm not arguing that we shouldn't look at these social categories, but the point really is that in many cases, those social categories are not the causal variable. It's something else.
The 65 number that he was talking about is when Medicare kicks in. So he's exactly right. If you can get to that age, then you have guaranteed health insurance. And I counsel a lot of people that are disabled. They're in their late 50s, early 60s. They don't have health insurance, and one of the unfortunate things is I hear a lot they don't have money for medicines, so they don't go to the doctor, or they cut their pills in half and try to work with half the medication they should be taking, and that seems to be a problem that I'm starting to see more and more as well. It seems like late 50s, early 60s, they can or don't want to work anymore. They have health issues, and it goes to the stress. So that affects their health. And one of the things I've noticed, it seems like that population is so stressed that they seem to have more health issues. Of course, part of it is the body breaks down, but stress definitely brings on health problems as well. And we need to do a better job of de-stressing in this country. We need to be healthier. We need to exercise. It's amazing, you know, it's like the doctor said, I think a lot of our problems are self-induced. And I'm looking in the mirror because I need to exercise more as well.
Jessica, do you want to share some of the de-stressing techniques that would be useful if they were adopted across the board, or?
Well, sure. You know, I definitely talk a lot to my patients about trying to find a balance, you know, in life. That sometimes, you know, if you're working too hard, then stress can overtake you. But if you're playing too hard, then that can create a problem as well. So, you know, finding a balance, doing things that help relax you. There's meditation, yoga, you know, doing some deep breathing, getting active, having, you know, that exercise routine. And doing it for long-term health is really key. And coming and not being afraid to get counseling when you feel like you're in over your head, because we do know that psychological treatment does work and has positive outcomes. So many times if you have access to healthcare and you have good insurance that will, you know, help cover you if you have a broken leg, you're not afraid to go get help for that broken leg. But unfortunately, sometimes in our society, if we have depression or anxiety, we're fine. We don't want anyone to know about it, and we don't need help. But there is a lot of good treatment out there.
So here's a question from the audience. What is the most wasteful expenditure people in debt tend to make? Jeff?
Bar none, in my 21 years of experience, people buy vehicles they can't afford. We love our cars in this country. Transportation is a huge money waster. And then I would say, excuse me, Monarch, eating out is a problem. Matter of fact, just yesterday I counseled a couple with two kids, and they spent $300 a month at the grocery store and $400 a month eating out. So... those are definitely the two biggest things are vehicles and eating out, in my experience. And the third one would be cell phones.
Is it common, I don't know if anyone has statistics on this, but is it common for people to pull themselves out of debt after it's piled up, or does it just get worse and worse for the majority of people? I think maybe some people tend to think that, you know, you get into all this debt and you can never get out. Is that a misconception, or is it as bad as it seems once you're in it?
You can get out. There's ways, but it takes a lot of hard work. It's like I tell my clients, you don't get into debt overnight. You don't get out. There are some situations where bankruptcy is probably the best and only option.
And then with younger groups and maybe senior citizens, how does this strain manifest differently in the health of different groups?
Anyone can jump in. So as it turns out, when I mentioned in my opening statement that the United States compares unfavorably to other industrialized countries, the one area where we compare favorably is if you hit the age of 65. So if you can hit the age of 65 in this country, you're more likely to live a longer life. And so the impact of wealth and these other factors on the elderly, if you can make it to that certain point, things tend to get better. But in terms of the impact on other groups, we tend to segment groups into ethnicity, race, and some of these other factors where the common link for many of them is really low income. right? And so, as it turns out, when we, you know, focus on this group composition and sort of dividing people, you know, among races and ethnicity, we actually ignore certain groups. And one of the groups that gets ignored is the low-income white population, right? Which causes society to pay less attention to that group, and they obviously they recognize this, right? And so there's a tremendous opportunity for people to align around this idea around income, you know, and not to say that these other distinctions don't matter, but those other distinctions are not causal factors, right? Race does not cause health. It doesn't. It just so happens that people are in a certain social category of a race experience disproportionate impacts of this link between income. They're more likely to find themselves in a lower income, and therefore that puts them in a bad neighborhood, and then there's a cascading effect from there. But the same is true for other groups. And so I'm not arguing that we shouldn't look at these social categories, but the point really is that in many cases, those social categories are not the causal variable. It's something else.
The 65 number that he was talking about is when Medicare kicks in. So he's exactly right. If you can get to that age, then you have guaranteed health insurance. And I counsel a lot of people that are disabled. They're in their late 50s, early 60s. They don't have health insurance. And one of the unfortunate things is I hear a lot they don't have money for medicines, so they don't go to the doctor, or they cut their pills in half and try to work with half the medication they should be taking. And that seems to be a problem that I'm starting to see more and more as well. It seems like late 50s, early 60s, they can or don't want to work anymore. They have health issues, and it goes to the stress. So that affects their health. And one of the things I've noticed, it seems like that population is so stressed that they seem to have more health issues. Of course, part of it is the body breaks down, but stress definitely brings on health problems as well. And we need to do a better job of de-stressing in this country. We need to be healthier. We need to exercise. It's amazing, you know, it's like the doctor said, I think a lot of our problems are self-induced. And I'm looking in the mirror because I need to exercise more as well.
Jessica, do you want to share some of the de-stressing techniques that would be useful if they were adopted across the board, or?
Well, sure. You know, I definitely talk a lot to my patients about trying to find a balance, you know, in life. That sometimes, you know, if you're working too hard, then stress can overtake you. But if you're playing too hard, then that can create a problem as well. So, you know, finding a balance, doing things that help relax you. There's meditation, yoga, you know, doing some deep breathing, getting active, having, you know, that exercise routine. And doing it for long-term health is really key. And coming and not being afraid to get counseling when you feel like you're in over your head, because we do know that psychological treatment does work and has positive outcomes. So many times if you have access to healthcare and you have good insurance that will, you know, help cover you if you have a broken leg, you're not afraid to go get help for that broken leg. But unfortunately, sometimes in our society, if we have depression or anxiety, we're fine. We don't want anyone to know about it, and we don't need help. But there is a lot of good treatment out there.
So here's a question from the audience. What is the most wasteful expenditure people in debt tend to make? Jeff?
Bar none, in my 21 years of experience, people buy vehicles they can't afford. We love our cars in this country. Transportation is a huge money waster. And then I would say, excuse me, Monarch, eating out is a problem. Matter of fact, just yesterday I counseled a couple with two kids, and they spent $300 a month at the grocery store and $400 a month eating out. So, yeah, those are definitely the two biggest things are vehicles and eating out, in my experience. And the third one would be cell phones.
Is it common, I don't know if anyone has statistics on this, but is it common for people to pull themselves out of debt after it's piled up, or does it just get worse and worse for the majority of people? I think maybe some people tend to think that, you know, you get into all this debt and you can never get out. Is that a misconception, or is it as bad as it seems once you're in it?
You can get out. There's ways. But it takes a lot of hard work. It's like I tell my clients, you don't get into debt overnight, you don't get out. There are some situations where bankruptcy is probably the best and only option.
Well, that's a political question, and I am in Kansas. I was told that we don't discuss politics here. But if we look at other industrialized countries that have moved toward universal health care and a single-payer system, what we find is that there are tremendous efficiencies to be gained by moving in that direction. Look at it from perhaps a different perspective. Right now, healthcare in this country is perceived to be a business, right? And so there's an incentive structure for health insurance companies and for, in many cases, healthcare providers to make lots of money, right? And so there's this transfer of wealth moving around from one group to another. Why? Because we have a fragmented health system without a single payer or universal health care. And so I think there are arguments to be made around the benefits of moving toward a single payer health system, but ultimately it's a political question. And the one value that people tend to rally around in this country is that of individual liberty. And individual liberty would dictate that individuals have a fundamental right to get rich if they want to, right? And so we are reluctant to restrict the rights of insurance companies or individuals to use the healthcare market as a means of accumulating wealth. I'd like to go back to the suggestion just a moment ago regarding this relationship between education and health, because you looked at me when you said, well, I don't know if you agree, and I do agree that education is very influential in health. In fact, more people die from low education than from heart attacks, right? So it goes back to that fundamental issue that I keep talking about. The social, the behavioral, and the environmental factors explain more of a person's health than does healthcare. And so as it turns out, education matters, and it matters more than heart attacks.
Anyone else want to weigh in on that one? Okay, we'll move on here. Another audience question. What about the effect on the broader community when people without money use emergency health care and the expenses must be covered by the government?
So typically what will happen is if a health facility has unreimbursed costs, then that's going to increase their cost of doing business, and that cost has to be transferred somewhere, and that's where they get into raising prices. So where the government may step in is where some states might have what they call an uncompensated care fund, where they would allow a hospital or a clinic to basically get reimbursement through another mechanism. In the state of Maryland, where I'm from perhaps most recently, and it's been quite some time since I've done hospital rate setting, but we actually had a system in place that allowed hospitals to charge a rate that recouped their costs of providing uncompensated care. And so it was a measure that we tracked every year, and we were able to see, you know, the extent of uncompensated care across all the 56 hospitals, and then design a rate that allowed hospitals to recoup that cost. And it was, you know, very basic around, you know, basically taking a look at the underlying cost structure of the hospital and making sure that you charge a rate that, you know, covers the full cost plus a reasonable amount of profit.
Does anyone want to address that question as well? Okay. Here's another audience question. How does poor dental health affect other conditions such as heart disease and suicide?
We're looking at the health guy.
Is there a dentist in the office?
So, as it turns out, dental care is for lower income families, it's a Medicaid option. So the states have an option of whether or not to include dental care in the state Medicaid plan, which leads to wide variations across the states. And what we've noticed in communities where there's a lack of dental care, actually you can die from dental disease. In fact, we had a case in the state of Maryland maybe about 10 years ago where a young child below the age of 10 had gone without dental care for so long that it actually did cause him to die. And then of course that led to a reaction where we started to take a look at, you know, dental care and the extent to which dental care was being provided to lower income families. But it didn't go anywhere, right? So we have these catastrophic events that leads to these investigations, but we're reluctant to create the kind of changes that would produce the outcomes that we think we want. I think most of us agree that when people are sick, they should have some medical care. But what we don't agree on is whether or not people without the resources to pay for that health care should get that health care. In fact, fundamentally, we believe because we have a health care market and we don't believe in the notion that health care is a right, that if you don't have resources, then you don't have a demand for health, right? And that is a personal situation, and it's not a matter that the collective should be concerned about.
Here's an audience question that can kind of maybe give some good perspective on something we were discussing earlier about bankruptcy. If you want to describe what it means for an individual to file for bankruptcy, maybe not everyone is familiar.
Well, again, I'm not an attorney, so I don't want anybody suing me. In Kansas, and every state has different laws, depending on your financial situation, and it's done in federal court, certain debts can be discharged in what's called a bankruptcy. That's where you have to show the court your finances, your income, your expenses, your debt obligations, and then the court can say, yes, you can file. And there's typically two types of bankruptcy. There's what's called a Chapter 7. Again, I'm not an attorney, so I'm not giving legal advice if there's any attorneys out here. And that's where, based on the income in Sedgwick County, you may be able to walk away from some of your debts. Typically what happens is people want to keep their house and their car, so they keep making those payments outside of the bankruptcy, and then they can walk away from the other debts. And it's usually credit card debt, medical bills, things like that. Then they also have a reorganization bankruptcy, and it's called a Chapter 13. And based on your ability to pay and your income, you may make a payment to the court, and it may be $100 a month, $200 a month. You make it over time, and that money is paid to your creditors. And interest can't accrue during that time frame, and they can't sue you, they can't harass you for the debt. To me, that's one of the best things about a bankruptcy, if that's what you have to do, is the creditors can't harass you for the money, and they can't call you. And that's usually what I see a lot in my counseling, is when they come see me, is when they start getting the phone calls, and they're scared, and they don't know what to do. And so then we counsel them on what options that they have at that point.
And emotionally, that oftentimes leads to some denial about how bad the debt has gotten, where you will have, people that are not opening their statements, they're, shoving them in drawers, and then that just leads to an accrual and an increase in the problem.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that debt is mostly an issue for lower income people, or is that just sort of a misconception and higher income people also tend to have? You're nodding. Okay.
Yeah.
What do you think, Jeff?
Well, in my experience, it's not necessarily low income. And to be honest, a lot of times because they're low income and their credit score may be too low, they don't have a lot of debt because they can't borrow the money. Their debt is typically from a collection agency. It's not like a house and a car and major credit card debt. You know, I had a client, it's been a couple months ago, and they made over six-figure income, but their debt was $250,000. So I've always said it's not what you make in life, it's what you choose, how you choose to spend it.
So are there other organizations like the CCCS that are legitimate? Is there government funding for these sorts of efforts? You can see offers all the time on TV and different sources that claim that they'll help. How much of that is true?
For the most part, those agencies are legitimate. I wish you would come to our agency because we're local, and hopefully you understand what we do is to help you. We're not trying to make money off of you. A lot of those are nonprofits, but they have a they're trying to make a profit, and we're not. We're a true nonprofit. We're community-based. Speaking of the federal funding, most of that has dried up as government is going broke on a federal and state level. Almost all of our funding for our programs have dried up as well. And one thing I didn't mention earlier, we're a United Way funded agency. So if you give to the United Way, thank you for that. That money does come to my agency and helps our programs so we can counsel for free of charge. So if you see them on TV, look at them with a hairy eyeball. They're probably legitimate, but again, they're for-profit business models versus nonprofit business models.
I have one more follow-up to that for you. It seems like the further in debt you get, the more credit you're offered, the more, credit card offers come in the mail and that sort of thing. What is that? Where is that coming from? What is the trigger for that?
Well, a lot of people don't realize this, but creditors can look at your credit report and they see that you're making payments on time. And since they're charging interest, and the average credit card right now is at 16% interest, they're making a lot of money. So if you have a high credit score and they see that you're borrowing the money and you're making payments, they're just trying to make money as well, and that's how that works. It's interesting because after the economy crashed in 2008, it seemed like a lot of that dried up, and we didn't see a lot of situations where people had very large credit card debt, but it's starting to trickle back in, and like I said earlier, I'm getting a little nervous because it's starting to get busy again, and a lot of times I'm the barometer for what's going on, so it's going to be interesting. I think it's going to be an interesting 2 years to see what happens in the United States for a variety of reasons.
Here's another audience question. It sounds like either people need more money or healthcare needs to be more affordable. Without either, we can't reasonably expect to solve economic-induced health problems. What's your response to that? What's the way out? Sam, do you want to kick this one off?
Well, given that my argument is that we need to spend less money on health care and more money on prevention, then I think giving people more money or allowing people to earn more money does have an effect on their health. Because we've identified this relationship that income, as it goes up, people's health status go up. So there's a correlation between income and health for individuals. But in terms of dealing with the problems more broadly, what we need from a policy perspective is the redirection of some of that $3.2 trillion into some of these areas where it could make a difference. We need to spend some money on smoking cessation programs, obesity reduction programs, and on these social, behavioral, and environmental issues that are 80% of the determinants of health. So it's a matter of spending the money more efficiently. You can spend the money more efficiently if you put it in prevention as opposed to dealing with the problems on the back end. Think of it this way. If we prevented the problem from occurring in the first place, we won't have to spend money trying to fix it. Because honestly, by the time you get really, really sick, it's too late, right? So it's a lot more worthwhile to prevent cancer than it is to try to cure it. Because our options on the cure side, while they're improving, they aren't very good. And the same is true for many of these other diseases. And so if we could shift our focus away from these medical causes of health and pay more attention to the non-medical, and it's just a matter of shifting dollars. We're spending trillions of dollars, and that number has been going up, right? We spend more money, a higher percentage of our GDP than any other country in the world, bar none. So is it a matter of putting more money into the system? Not so much. It's more of a matter of using the money that we're currently spending more wisely.
Jessica, I don't know if you can address this one, being a physician, but what is being done to educate physicians about reducing patient stress? Are there programs, or what's going on in that realm?
Well, I'm trained as a psychologist, and I don't have a medical background, but I do know that many medical facilities are recognizing the importance of integrated healthcare and integrating behavioral health into their practices, and we're seeing a higher demand in that for training psychologists, wanting them to be working in an integrated healthcare facility where your doctor, who can say you need to make some behavioral lifestyle changes, can walk down the hall and find a psychologist like myself who specializes in behavior change, and they can say go consult with the psychologist, and they can help you come up with a plan to change your behavior to get better health. So we're definitely seeing the healthcare industry recognizing that integrating behavioral health is important.
This one from the audience is also directed at you, Jessica. How has the political climate of healthcare in the state of Kansas influenced healthcare or the lack thereof, especially in mental health?
Can you repeat the question?
How the political climate of healthcare here in Kansas has influenced mental health, essentially. Has it had an impact?
Yeah, I think what I've seen is a lot of uncertainty and insecurity about the future. I know I deal with, some clients, one I can think of, that I'm meeting with recently, who has a autoimmune disorder and did not have access to health care before the Affordable Care Act. And now, some of the things that we spend a lot of our time discussing is her anxiety and her fear over her ability to get health care in the future.
This one goes back to what you were talking about earlier, Sam. In regards to decreased health outcomes in the U.S., compared to other developed countries, how much of a factor is it that our healthcare is primarily a for-profit enterprise? And would people be better able to access healthcare and medication if profit was not such a factor? Sort of an opinion, but
it's an argument. An argument has at least two sides. So one side of the argument is that because we have the profit motive in our healthcare system, actually do have the best health care in the world, right? That's one argument. And then the other argument is, well, what about these outcomes? The infant mortality rates, right, being relatively high. When you look at the life expectancy from birth, in the United States, it compares less favorably to other industrialized countries. So it depends on what evidence you want to use to support the argument that you want to make, whether profit in the industry is good or bad. Because there's evidence on both sides of the argument, which makes it difficult, to offer a conclusive, opinion on a matter, because it's open for debate. If we didn't have a for-profit healthcare system, people wouldn't be flying from all over the world to get access to certain healthcare, right? So the for-profit folks who argue for a for-profit healthcare system would say that when these people in these countries that have universal healthcare with the single-payer systems, right, one of the problems you get with that is a waiting list. So you can't get access to the care when you think you need it, right, or when you want it. And those people with money, they can come to this country and get that health care. And so some people think that's a good thing, right? That we can be a provider of health care services to the world, provided you have the money to buy it. And so it's really a values question. Do you value, individual liberty and having people enjoy the freedom to purchase what they want when they want it, versus do you value this notion of universal access, healthcare as a right? And that's where we don't have a consensus in this country. And most people would probably fall down on the side of individual liberty over the notion of providing some health care for all.
So this question relates a little bit, another audience question here. The woman says, I work at an organization that operates homeless shelters and low-income apartments. Smoking and unhealthy food are common, but the people just don't seem to think a change in lifestyle is affordable. ER visits, substitute for primary care providers. Even with the ACA, we haven't noticed much change in that. What will it take to actually have affordable health care?
Well, it sort of goes back to the question that you posed around what are the politics like in Kansas? So even in Kansas under the Affordable Care Act, the state chose not to expand Medicaid to individuals with certain percentage of the federal poverty level. And that has left a larger number of people with without insurance. But this issue of homeless people with low income, that population actually should be eligible for Medicaid, and so that policy wouldn't affect them directly. The challenge is, how do we motivate individuals in those categories to change their behavior? And one of the ways that we can motivate them is to actually provide them with the better options, right? So it goes back to your question around the food deserts. Why are these individuals, choosing to eat, foods that are unhealthy? In many cases, it's not a real option for them, right? They don't have the option to go to the Sprouts on 21st and Rock Road. A higher percentage of our GDP than any other country in the world, bar none. So is it a matter of putting more money into the system? Not so much. It's more of a matter of using the money that we're currently spending more wisely.
Jessica, I don't know if you can address this one, being a physician, but what is being done to educate physicians about reducing patient stress? Are there programs, or what's going on in that realm?
Well, I'm trained as a psychologist, and I don't have a medical background, but I do know that many medical facilities are recognizing the importance of integrated healthcare and integrating behavioral health into their practices, and we're seeing a higher demand in that. For training psychologists, wanting them to be working in an integrated healthcare facility where your doctor, who can say you need to make some behavioral lifestyle changes, can walk down the hall and find a psychologist like myself who specializes in behavior change, and they can say go consult with the psychologist, and they can help you come up with a plan to change your behavior to get better health. So we're definitely seeing the healthcare industry recognizing that integrating behavioral health is important.
This one from the audience is also directed at you, Jessica. How has the political climate of healthcare in the state of Kansas influenced healthcare or the lack thereof, especially in mental health?
Can you repeat the question?
How the political climate of healthcare here in Kansas has influenced mental health, essentially. Mm-hmm. Has it had an impact?
Yeah, I think what I've seen is a lot of uncertainty and insecurity about the future. I know I deal with, some clients, one I can think of, that I'm meeting with recently, who has a autoimmune disorder and did not have access to health care before the Affordable Care Act. And now, some of the things that we spend a lot of our time discussing is her anxiety and her fear over her ability to get health care in the future.
This one goes back to what you were talking about earlier, Sam. In regards to decreased health outcomes in the U.S., compared to other developed countries, how much of a factor is it that our healthcare is primarily a for-profit enterprise? And would people be better able to access healthcare and medication if profit was not such a factor? Sort of an opinion, but
yeah, it's an argument. So some an argument that has at least two sides. So one side of the argument is that because we have the profit motive in our healthcare system, we actually do have the best healthcare in the world, right? That's one argument. And then the other argument is, well, what about these outcomes? The infant mortality rates, right, being relatively high. When you look at the life expectancy from birth, in the United States, it compares less favorably to other industrialized countries. So it depends on what evidence you want to use to support the argument that you want to make, whether profit in the industry is good or bad. Because there's evidence on both sides of the argument, which makes it difficult, to offer a conclusive, opinion on a matter, because it's open for debate. If we didn't have a for-profit healthcare system, people wouldn't be flying from all over the world to get access to certain healthcare, right? So the for-profit folks who argue for a for-profit healthcare system would say that when these people in these countries that have universal healthcare with the single-payer systems, right, one of the problems you get with that is a waiting list. So you can't get access to the care when you think you need it, right, or when you want it. And those people with money, they can come to this country and get that health care. And so some people think that's a good thing, right? That we can be a provider of health care services to the world, provided you have the money to buy it. And so it's really a values question. You know, do you value, individual liberty and having people enjoy the freedom to purchase what they want when they want it, versus do you value this notion of universal access, healthcare as a right? And that's where we don't have a consensus in this country. And most people would probably fall down on the side of individual liberty over the notion of providing some healthcare for all.
So this question relates a little bit, another audience question here. The woman says, I work at an organization that operates homeless shelters and low-income apartments. Smoking and unhealthy food are common. But the people just don't seem to think a change in lifestyle is affordable. ER visits, substitute for primary care providers. Even with the ACA, we haven't noticed much change in that. What will it take to actually have affordable health care?
Well, it sort of goes back to the question that you posed around what are the politics like in Kansas? So even in Kansas, under the Affordable Care Act, the state chose not to expand Medicaid to individuals with a certain percentage of the federal poverty level. And that has left a larger number of people with without insurance. But this issue of homeless people with low income, that population actually should be eligible for Medicaid, and so that policy wouldn't affect them directly. The challenge is, how do we motivate individuals in those categories to change their behavior? And one of the ways that we can motivate them is to actually provide them with the better options, right? So it goes back to your question around the food deserts. Why are these individuals, choosing to eat, foods that are unhealthy? In many cases, it's not a real option for them. Right? They don't have the option to go to the Sprouts on 21st and Rock Road. They are forced to purchase their foods in these convenience stores or fast food, which is less expensive than some of the healthier options. And that's where this notion of wealth actually does make a difference, because wealth equals opportunity. Wealth equals opportunity for health. The lack of wealth reduces your opportunities for health. And that's what you see more severely in these disadvantaged populations, the homeless and the extremely low income.
Jessica, maybe you can address this or kick this off for us. What are some educational tools that might help people to prevent fiscal disaster, specifically for students, other groups as well, if you have a read on that?
Well, I like the other panelist idea early about integrating, personal finance into, earlier education. I think that's really important. But in terms of changing some of their behaviors, it I think starts off small. That's many times we tackle this big challenge with it's your New Year's resolution and you're going to get out of debt, and that sets us up for failure oftentimes, and so people get discouraged. Before they know it, a few days into it, they're back into their old habits. So it's important, I think, to start off small and to set yourself up for success. Maybe it's that Tuesday night eating out on the credit card that you're going to deny yourself at first. And once you feel like, hey, I've got that under my belt, maybe you can start doing more. So start off small, set yourself up for success. The more you build on those successes, the more confident that you'll become that you can change these behaviors and you can start to, overcome. And we do know that when people get out of debt, that idea, that colloquialism of the freedom from debt is very true, that stress rates go down, happiness goes up, and so it's a very liberating experience.
We talked a little bit about kind of the tricks that people can fall prey to. What other sort of tricks are out there that draw people deeper into debt? It seems sometimes as if the system is structured to set us up for failure. What is your take on that, if you want to kick that off?
Sure. One of the things I like to talk about is we watch a lot of TV in the society, and we watch commercials. And marketing is designed specifically to take money out of your pocket. And one thing I say a lot is you see commercials that say, you deserve this. Super Bowl ads are millions of dollars. There's a reason for that, because they're so successful. We're a consumption society. We get a lot of pleasure out of, buying newer and bigger and better. And, it's amazing to me how things are designed against us and we don't even realize it. One thing that I became aware of fairly recently is cell phones. They're now designing cell phones where you can't change the battery to force you to buy a new one. And cell phones are $600, $700, $800. So if you think about it, if the battery only lasts 2 or 3 years, you're replacing that cell phone at $800. And a lot of times people don't even think about it because they just put it into their monthly payment. So they've gotten used to paying $60, $70, $80 a month for a cell phone, and that's by design. Microsoft is another example. Their products become obsolete on purpose because they're forcing you to upgrade to get a newer computer that can handle the software that they're designing. So there's definitely tricks out there. I'm kind of different than most people. I don't like to spend money. My family's here, and they'll tell you that when we spend money, we make sure that we're always trying to get the best deal that we possibly can. Because as a nonprofit director, I don't make a ton of money, so my choice is to not spend it. And when I do spend it, I always try to make sure that I'm getting the best deal.
And I think that it's common for people to feel pressure and to experience some embarrassment and some shame when they might not be able to afford that, that extra night out. So it's this idea of, kind of being embarrassed.
They want to keep up with their Facebook image.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yes.
So this is sort of changing topics a little bit. Are we seeing a larger influx of mentally ill on the streets? Do any of you have a read on that?
I don't know if there's a major influx, but if you can recall, in the 1960s, there was a movement to deinstitutionalize the mentally ill, and that led to, we didn't create a system in the community to handle the capacity of that movement. And as a result, we've seen a shift in the mentally ill population into a number of arenas. Many of them are on the street as homeless persons. Many of them are incarcerated, so and not getting the treatment that they need. And so our failure to design a community-based system to deal with that policy change, to move folks out of institutions, has created this problem of, you know, increased homelessness among the mentally ill.
I disagree. There's unintended consequences and effects of trying to deinstitutionalize the treatment to get more humane treatment, but then, yeah, there weren't options in place. So,
here's another audience question, something more specific. Do you have any tips for a single mother of a disabled child?
Develop strong advocacy skills. Right, so it goes back to one of the points that I was making earlier about having a voice. And so in becoming more knowledgeable about what's available for your child. Because the child is in a disadvantaged position, it's incumbent upon the parent to take on a more significant role in ensuring that the kid gets the care that he or she needs. So I would recommend developing advocacy skills, building relationships with providers and other parents to become more knowledgeable about the system and how that the current system can be used in order to get the best and most effective care for your child.
Yeah, I'm regularly talking with patients about how they can be their own advocate in their healthcare. And how they need to learn about the resources that are available and, you know, prepare themselves with the right questions to ask their doctors. And many people aren't really familiar sometimes with that concept that they have to be their own self-advocate in their care.
If anyone wants to get out your crystal ball, this next question's interesting. Credit card debt is at an all-time high, says the audience member. The new car finance debt is beginning to rival house debt of 2008. How far away do you think the next crash is?
Well, that's a tough. I do have an undergraduate degree in economics, but I haven't practiced it in quite some time. The next crash, I think it depends on where the next bubble is going to come from. So the last crash that we saw in 2008 came from the housing market. The stock market seems to be headed, you know, at some point, how high can the Dow go? I mean, we've passed the 22,000 mark. So some people think that the time for a market correction is near. And I can't tell you when that's going to happen. So, you know, so unfortunately, you know, I'm not as knowledgeable as the people who are in the field every day who know how to play it from all sides. Right, and so there's a way that you can invest in the market so that you can make money no matter what. And usually the super wealthy have access to those kinds of opportunities. But when is it gonna come? It's anybody's guess, but the theory is that the market tends to correct. And so, you know, these sustained increases cannot go for too much longer. So at some point, it's gonna turn. And I think perhaps the next downturn in the economy might be driven by perhaps the stock market, if I had to guess.
And I'm trained as a psychologist. I have no economic background, so I'm not even going to take a try at that one.
You know, he's exactly right. Nobody really knows, but what I would encourage you to do is just prepare for it so it's not such a big issue for you. If you're close to retirement and you're worried about it, then I would suggest you talk to your financial planner and get some advice that way. Because there's some strategies that you can do to get out of the market and get into more secure investing to where maybe it's not so bad. Because he's exactly right. In 2008, it got really bad at my agency. I had 21 employees, and we were counseling hundreds of people a week. And that's my biggest fear as we get back to that point. We were, you know, counseling folks that were getting ready to retire and they had too much money in the market. And then all of a sudden they were faced with having to work longer. And that's something that we see that people, there's a fear factor. You know, when do I retire? Can I retire at a decent age? Can I even work long enough? And I see that a lot, and one thing I'm seeing in my counseling is there is that fear factor right now with people, is my job going to be here? We've seen a lot of jobs here in Wichita go away or get outsourced. And one thing I encourage a lot of the high school students that I talk with is before you go to college, please research the career path that you're looking for, because jobs are starting to go away. The internet is an amazing thing, but it's also caused a lot of jobs to disappear because they can be outsourced to other countries for less money. You know, they make less with no benefits. And so it's very important before you go into debt to go to college to make sure that you know what you're getting into and that you can be able to make those student loan payments. And another thing I'd like to mention, if you're a parent, does anybody have kids in college? Do not take out a Parent PLUS loan to send your kid to college. If you have to, your kid can't afford that college, period. Those are also backed by the government, and those have to be paid back as well. I'm starting to see that as a problem, not only student debt, but I'm also seeing the parents with Parent PLUS loans that are coming in. I had a couple that sent both of their children to KU and owed over $75,000 in Parent PLUS loans to send them to KU.
Jeff, what about debt that is acquired from a parent or a spouse after they pass away? You know, something that maybe is unexpected, and all of a sudden you have a mountain of debt from someone else. What are some ways to either prevent that or to cope with that if that were to happen?
When a parent passes, if your name is not on that loan, that debt doesn't go to you, so it's not your debt. If your spouse had debt and they passed away, if your name's not on it, technically you wouldn't have to pay it back. A lot of times you can just notify the companies and let them know that. Now, they have the right to come after the estate to collect the money, but I don't normally see that situation. So if you have an elderly parent that has debt, don't worry, it's not going to pass to you. It's not your responsibility unless your name is on the note.
We've got a couple more audience questions that I want to try to get through before we wrap up today. Are there any community-based programs to keep restaurants or food-type corporations from wasting as much food and serving people that need help? This is sort of sideways a little bit, but a very interesting idea.
Well, there's a relatively new term that's been introduced in higher education. It's called social entrepreneurship. Social entrepreneurs look for ways to not only protect the environment, but look for ways to redirect resources, like say, you know, this issue of wasted food, getting it to people who obviously need food. So I know that there are conversations among social entrepreneurs to take food from restaurants that it's not good enough to continue serving in a restaurant, but it's not so bad that it needs to be thrown out. So the challenge is, how do you get that food to people who are hungry and could benefit from it? And that's where the role of social entrepreneurship may come in. If you can figure out a way to, you know, basically move the food from one place to another and earn a profit, then social entrepreneurship offers a solution. I know that there are some entrepreneurs in Wichita that are interested in this construct. In fact, they're looking at things like what many restaurants might consider waste, like the wheat that's used to produce beer. And there are actually things that you can do with that wheat. Right now, we're actually sending it to farmers for pig feed. So as it turns out, that wheat is filled with nutrients and could be sort of recycled into some other product that could be, you know, used on the market to improve the health of the everyday consumer. So I think social entrepreneurship is one option, but just being creative nonprofits could intervene and perhaps, you know, serve as an intermediary between those restaurants and the hungry people who could benefit from those foods.
Can I talk about that? One thing I'd like to say, and I don't quite understand it, it seems like the amount of food that they service anymore is more food than we can eat. I was reading an article the other day that said Europeans are shocked when they visit here, the amount of food that they are served when they eat in a restaurant, because in Europe that's not the case. if we would just give us less food and maybe cut the cost a little bit, that would be my solution in that situation. And we've been talking about obesity. You know, you feel guilty when you leave food on your plate. Anybody have a mom or dad or grandma who said you're not leaving the table till you finish all your food? Well, you know, that still strikes us in our adulthood that we still feel the need to do that. So that would be my suggestion.
I want to get through just a couple more audience questions here. Can you talk a little bit about reverse mortgages and whether they're a good or bad thing?
Reverse mortgages is a product that was developed in the last 20, 25 years. And the way it works is if you're 62 or older and you have equity in your house, a lot of times you can borrow against your house to help bring money into your household. You can take it in a lump sum. You can take it as an equity line of credit and you pull it as you need it. Or you can get a monthly amount to help you pay your bills. It's a difficult product. I've got mixed feelings about it. A lot of times elderly people don't want to leave their house, and I really get that. But a lot of times maybe they can't afford it, so they borrow against it. The good thing about a reverse mortgage is you don't have to make a monthly payment, and the house goes back to the bank, or it's sold when you either go to a nursing home, you choose to sell it, or you pass away. It's a very complicated product. They even have it where I've seen people can even build a house now with a reverse mortgage. It is government-backed as well. I'm not a big fan of the government being in that. Now, one of the downsides to reverse mortgage is you still have to pay your property taxes and insurance, and you have to maintain the property. And unfortunately, I've seen situations where the elderly person was asked to leave the house because they weren't paying their property taxes or their insurance. And that's always a sad situation to see that happen. But it is an option. To me, it's not your first option. But it's definitely there. My agency does the counseling for those. In order to get one, you have to have a counseling session that's mandated by HUD, just so you understand your options. So if you're interested in getting one, just give us a call, and we'll be happy to counsel you about it.
So we have time for one more audience question. It actually dovetails pretty well with that topic. Are there any community-based programs that help with housing costs, either fixing problems with existing houses or income-based housing, and how effective are programs like these?
Well, there are some nonprofits out there that help with housing situations. The city of Wichita has a few programs as well that can help. There's probably not as many as there needs to be because housing is an issue. We don't have enough low-income housing. If you know anything about Section 8, it's a big waiting list right now. So there are some programs. You just need to contact 211 the United Way, and they can help steer you towards those programs that are available to you.
Thank you. And then I have one last question for all of you. What can we do, one, to help ensure our own futures are a little brighter, but also what can we do to help others? This is a very personal topic, a very individual topic, but are there things that we can do, simple ways for us to help others in our community?
Well, we could always use some help in getting the word out about the social determinants of health. And so the conversation that we had tonight around the non-medical causes, explaining more of health status than medical causes, then it actually does offer some hope to folks. Right, it gives them the information that behavioral changes can affect your health status and the health outcomes. Stop smoking. Deal with obesity. Eat a proper diet. You know, try and access the highest quality of housing that you possibly can. And so I think that there's a message that we can get out to the broader community around the benefits of prevention, as opposed to waiting until you get sick to seek some sort of care. So it's the very simple, a statement, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Getting that message out, I think, will go a long way.
And I would like to add to see asking for help as something that is a sign of courage and that it's a brave act and that it's not a sign of weakness. I think there's a lot of help out there, a lot of resources to educate yourself and to help you get out of some of these situations, but many times people feel too embarrassed and ashamed to get the help that's out there. So try and think about that, reframe that a little bit, and think about it as a sign of bravery and courage to ask for help as opposed to a sign of personal weakness.
I would reiterate, prevention is something that we all need to do. One of the top 10 things I suggest for people financially is to be healthy, because if you're healthy, your costs are a lot lower when you get older. And the sad reality is when you are older, a lot of times you can't afford your medications or to go to the doctor. I had a woman I counseled just yesterday that is diabetic, and she's really struggling, and she said she also has heart trouble too, and she can't afford to go to the doctor. Well, we all know where that's going to be headed, and I told her point blank, I said, you just need to go see your cardiologist and not worry about paying on some of these credit cards that you've got, because if you're not here, it doesn't matter anyway. So prevention, in my opinion, is something we all need to do, and we all need to look in the mirror, because I think we all could do a lot better. And one thing I'd like to mention as a nonprofit director, I would love to see more volunteers, because nonprofits are really struggling right now. A lot of our funding is going away or it's gone, and the nonprofit world won't be here down the road if it's, number one, not supported financially, but number two, if people don't volunteer, because we could use a lot of help right now.
Thank you. Really interesting stuff. Let's have a big round of applause for our panel. I think that was a great discussion. We're going to put the audio for this up online at engageict.org if you'd like to send the link to someone who missed the discussion or who would like to listen to one of our previous discussions. Our next Engage ICT, usually these Democracy on Tap discussions are Tuesdays, but in September we will be talking on a Wednesday, September 13th, and we'll talk about the art of teaching innovations in the classroom. So that'll be a really good discussion as well. Thank you very much for coming. I hope you all as well have on your radar that KMUW is bringing Science Friday to Wichita. We're really excited about that. And that event will have come and gone by the next Engage ICT. So make sure if you are interested in attending, it's going to be an awesome, awesome discussion, or show, I should say, with Ira Flato and the whole crew. They're coming to Wichita. We're going to talk about sea monsters and dung beetles and all kinds of really interesting stuff. That's September 9th at the Orpheum. Get your tickets. You can find information at kmuw.org. Please join us for that. It's a once-in-a-lifetime thing here in Wichita. And thank you for coming out. I hope you all enjoyed the talk, and have a good night.
Thanks for joining us for Engage ICT Democracy on Tap. Find more podcasts and videos at engageict.org. This show was hosted at the Monarch in Wichita, Kansas. Our engineers are John Cyphers and Torin Anderson, and I'm the host. For KMUW, I'm Sarah Jane Crespo.